from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg. Drop
what you're doing. What seems ages ago, I wrote a piece for the New American Magazine. This would have been actually in 1993, if memory serves, in a cover story package in a special issue entitled Toward a Police State. Actually, I'm wrong. It was 1994. Toward a Police State was a sequel to a special issue that we did in 1993. And if I'm not mistaken, Toward a Police State was still, even today, the best-selling single issue of the New American, because it happened to tap into a rich vein of concern over what was going on in terms of militarizing and federalizing law enforcement, the potential threat to the right to keep and bear arms, all these things. It was really a perfect example of the right package of essays addressing the right set of topics at exactly the right time. You know, real synchronicity, if you will. One of the essays I wrote in that issue dealt with the question of how we perceive law enforcement and the changing role of law enforcement. Bear in mind, this is 16 years ago. And one of the points I made is that most people, even then, in the United States, felt not uneasy, but a little apprehensive when they happened to see a police car in their rearview mirror. And this was a change in our culture and in our perceptions that had taken place within the previous couple of decades. It used to be that we would look upon police, for the most part, with a sense of gratitude and trust. And there are plenty of people who carry out that role today who are trustworthy as individuals. The problem is the institution. The problem is the fact that there are institutional expectations now that militate against the best attempts, the best efforts of good, conscientious people who enlist in law enforcement out of a sense of wanting to serve and protect others, that is to say, to serve them by protecting their individual rights. There are plenty of people who are protective by nature and who have a calling, a vocation, if you will, toward the protection of other people, and this is how they want to carry out that function. But institutionally, the role that the police play is that of being the coercive arm of the government ruling us. And their function in society is, unfortunately, only peripherally related to the protection of life, liberty, and property. When such services are rendered, usually it's in spite of the institutional biases of the organization we're talking about. And that's one of the reasons why I cherish those people I know in law enforcement who, despite the pressures institutionally, culturally, and otherwise, are doing what they can, literally and honorably, to protect the individual rights of the people in whatever territory to which they're assigned. But that is a preface. I want to point out that we all now feel a certain unease when we look in the rearview mirror and we see that there is a police cruiser on our six. And whenever we find ourselves receiving the attention of law enforcement officers, we grow a little bit uncertain as to what it is they're interested in. Not because we've necessarily done something bad, not because we have a bad conscience, but because it's almost impossible to avoid doing something that could be treated as, if not a crime, at least the violation of some ordinance. We live within this dense thicket of enactments that we're told to treat as laws, any one of which could end up at any time provoking a potentially tragic confrontation between a well-intentioned and harmless citizen and an armed stranger who may or may not be the personality type I just described. It may or may not be somebody upon whom the mantle of presumed authority rests lightly, somebody who's not particularly interested in taking an awkward situation and turning it into an incident. Unfortunately, once again, institutionally, law enforcement selects for the type of people who tend to be more mercenary in their outlook and tend to be more inclined toward pushing people around. That's a cultural change, it's an institutional change, and it's just a manifestation of our sin nature. That's just the way we are for some reason. I don't know why. I'm still trying to understand that, doubt I ever will. I bring up this subject and dwell on it at some length because over the last couple of weeks, I've had some really interesting experiences I've written about on my Facebook page. Now, that's the first time I've ever name-dropped myself, if you will, in terms of my Facebook page. I don't intend to make that a habit. I am signed up for Twitter, but I don't tweet very often. I think that tweeting is insipid, probably won't do a whole lot of it. When I have the chance, I go to a local park here in the little town of Payette, Idaho, where I live, in western Idaho. There's a beautiful little park called Centennial Park, which is next to a river. It's sort of hard to avoid a river around here. There are four locally. I believe it's on the Payette River. And I do my calisthenics al fresco, which is the best way to exercise. It's best if you do this early in the morning. Sometimes I go early in the morning. If my schedule doesn't permit, I'll go at noon. Once again, my schedule allowing for such an expedition. If that's not possible, I go in the afternoon, late afternoon or early evening, because it's always a good idea to get out and absorb some natural vitamin D by way of hormesis, absorbing it from the sunlight, to breathe fresh air and to spend some time in motion. So what I'll do is I'll do calisthenics, usually a set of, 500 free squats, that is to say deep knee bends. They're like barbell squats without the weights. And maybe 100 Hindu push-ups and then do some hill sprints up the boat landing. That's what I like to do, and that's what I'm trying to do now by way of trying to get into some semblance of shape. Every time I go to the park, irrespective of the time of day, I end up being given a once-over by somebody in a police cruiser. It's just a really odd and consistently recurring thing. I'll be there for 10 minutes, and suddenly a police car will materialize, drive about a half mile, and then do a slow pass around the little section of the park where I'm exercising. And it doesn't matter where I go in Payette, that will happen to me every single time. I went to the Greenbelt quite a few times. There's a Greenbelt, which once again is by the riverside, and a police officer made a half-mile trip down a narrow road just to come and watch me do push-ups. Really a strange thing. This week, I'm trying to think of what day it was. I think it was Thursday. I'll have to go back and double-check this. I had my wife, Corinne, and our 19-month-old son, Justice, in tow. We just dropped off our daughter, Sophia, for kindergarten, and we decided to go to the local park. Corinne and Justice were going to play on the swing sets and enjoy the sunshine, and I was going to do my exercise regimen. So as we were heading over there, I mentioned to Corinne that every time I go there, the police seem to show up. Before we got to the park, we found ourselves surrounded, not in an aggressive or confrontational sense, but surrounded in the streets as we were driving by vehicles belonging to the Malheur County Sheriff's Department. Now, the Malheur County Sheriff's Department is from Oregon. It's across the Snake River boundary that separates Idaho from the People's Republic of Oregon. So we were basically part of a convoy, and we got to the park. I took a look at these people getting out of these vehicles, about a dozen of them, and I've got pictures of the vehicles, not of the police officers, unfortunately, but pictures of the vehicles I'm going to be posting on my blog. There were a dozen vehicles, including one that was pulling a large fan boat, a riverboat, the sort of thing you'd find, for instance, in Florida, perhaps, to negotiate the Keys. These guys got out wearing fatigues and carrying AR-15 rifles. They were the SWAT team. No, what was the SWAT team doing at Centennial Park? Had they been sent as reinforcements? We'll talk about this in just a few minutes here on the other side of the break. This is Pro Libertate Radio. Will Grigg on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in just a minute. one 866 986 6397 is our call number, 866-986-6397 here on the Liberty News Radio Network. When I left off the narrative, and doubtless, of course, you're on tenterhooks, breathless to find out how this encounter with the SWAT team from Malheur County turned out, I was in Centennial Park. It turns out it was Wednesday, not on Thursday, as I mistakenly reported. I went back and double-checked my earlier posting on the subject. I was there in Centennial Park, and en route, the car, that is to say the van I was driving, found itself in the middle of a convoy of vehicles from the Malheur County Sheriff's Department and one vehicle from the Payette County Sheriff's Department. Malheur County is in Oregon. Payette is in Idaho. In other words, these people came from out of state to go to the park, Centennial Park, which is where I do my workouts most of the time. When I have the opportunity to exercise outdoors, I avail myself of that opportunity. For some reason, the police always materialize. I don't know why this is, but it doesn't matter which park I go to or what time of day I go there. For some reason, the police always show up. Perhaps they're interested to see if I'm a malefactor of some sort. Perhaps they're concerned for my safety. Nonetheless, they always show up. I'm always genial. I always wave and smile. And I'm always too busy to talk to them because I'm in the middle of doing some kind of rigorous calisthenic. On this occasion, the SWAT team from Malheur County showed up, and they were all dressed in army fatigues, carrying automatic or semi-automatic weapons. I think they're semi-automatic weapons, AR-15. If I'm not mistaken, it's a semi-automatic weapon. In any case, they're what would be called assault rifles if they were in the hands of mere civilians. So I walked over amiably to the man who appeared to be in charge, a fellow wearing the standard-issue police officer's mustache, although he was dressed like a soldier. They said, "So, what are you doing here on this fine afternoon?" It was slightly afternoon on Wednesday. And he smiled and said, "We're just playing." Now, that's probably exactly what they were doing. I muttered under my breath, "Well, you got that right. They're getting paid to play." Why do I say this? Well, that's because that's how they describe the training that they do. They're boys playing with grown-up toys. This is from the Argus Observer newspaper from Ontario, Oregon, from the 21st of August. The article is entitled Critical Preparation, and it has a depiction of, let me think here, 4 SWAT team members wearing bucket helmets, Kevlar tactical vests, and camouflage pants, and then one individual dressed in Malheur County's tan uniform shirt and dark brown pants. They're being supervised by, I'm guessing, the fellow with whom I spoke, a fellow with a campaign hat, and I believe it's called a campaign hat, the camouflage hat and camouflage outfit. They're shooting at targets. Three of them, let me think, one, two, just a second. At least two of them are carrying the AR-15s. A couple of them are carrying probably a Glock sidearm. And they're at a shooting range, and I can tell you where they are. I think they're right next to Malheur Butte. There's a shooting range not far from Malheur Butte, which is an extinct volcano remnant near, actually it's between Ontario and Vail in that part of Oregon. The story quotes second-year officer Michael Hale in the SWAT team, which is actually called the Sheriff's Emergency Response Team, or CERT, S-E-R-T. "This is fun. This is what I did in the military. I get to shoot guns and play in the dirt. It is what I did as a kid. I just get paid for it now." Some of this gentleman responded that they were just playing, and to that extent, he was telling the truth. He didn't tell me what scenario they were playing out or if they were doing something more serious than a training exercise. In any case, these guys came kitted out as combat soldiers carrying combat weaponry, and they went tooling around on the river in a motorboat. And they were doing so on the taxpayer's dime. And the fact that they had emergency personnel from the Payette County paramedics suggests that there was something more serious than a mere training exercise going on. Those are people who were probably paid by the taxpayers. And there was at least one car carrying at least one person from the Payette County Sheriff's Department. So this was taxpayer-funded play. What I think is interesting is that after I went back to our house, retrieved a digital camera, and returned to this site, the park, to see if I could get some pictures of the personnel or at least of their vehicles. I was able to take pictures of the latter, but not the former. One of the neighbors from a house abutting the park property came ambling over to talk to me, and he took a look at this cluster of police vehicles and made reference to these people in camouflage carrying automatic weapons, and he said, "This is pretty cool. It'd be great if it were like this all the time. Would certainly be secure." I'm quoting as exactly as I can from memory. And I looked at him and said, "Well, I'd feel more secure if the guns were in the hands of people who weren't government employees." But think just for a second about that reflexive reaction and what it says about this guy's priorities and the way he perceives the world. I'm not trying to say that he's exceptionally foolish, because I don't think he is. I don't think that he's somebody who's particularly statist in his outlook. He's just sort of a typical American of a certain age. He's probably 5 or 6 years older than I am, or maybe a touch older than that. And so chances are his childhood memories of law enforcement don't include the formative trauma of Waco or the bombing of the MOVE in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, in I believe it was May of 1985. Some of you might remember that incident. Basically, the police took out an entire block of Philadelphia in order to get a couple of people suspected of various, I believe, petty crimes attached to what was described as a cult called the MOVE. It strikes me as, from what I know of the group, sort of your standard issue urban radical group with vaguely religious pretensions and a patina of Afro-Marxist revolutionary ideology. I don't know that bombing, firebombing an entire block, or entire residential block, was proportionate to whatever they had allegedly done. And the reason why that made such an impression on me is that I was literally heading into Philadelphia on the turnpike. I think the turnpike leads into Philadelphia. I was on one of the main highways leading into Philadelphia in any case. The morning that occurred, I was sitting in an equipment truck being driven by a friend of mine. I was part of a musical group. I was a musician with a touring group at the time. We happened to be going to Philadelphia the day that the MOVE was firebombed. And then 8 years later, I remember turning on the television at noon on Monday, April 19th, 1993, and seeing a church in flames. And knowing that within that church, actually, I found out later, my first impulse was to say, good heavens, I hope nobody is in there. I hope they all got out. It turns out none of them got out. And I was mortified by what I saw, knowing that there were people who were being immolated inside that church who had done nothing to deserve that type of treatment. At the time, I thought that this was merely culpable negligence and incompetence on the part of the federal law enforcement authorities who were involved in that siege. It turns out it was, first of all, not merely law enforcement authorities. We know that the FBI's hostage rescue team, which is their SWAT team, their paramilitary group, had been trained by Delta Force, but what I know from talking with people who were on site, or not on site necessarily, people who were in the decision-making chain that led to that final siege, is that there were Delta operators on the ground, probably in a trigger-pulling capacity, during the final siege at Waco. So those are some of the formative experiences that I had in my relative youth that really did a lot toward framing my perspective on how law enforcement can become very troublesome and very threatening when it's being carried out by people who are kitted out like soldiers rather than police, who are carrying weapons which are more appropriate for use on a battlefield rather than in civilian law enforcement, and people who have a mindset much more appropriate to carrying out a military occupation than being peace officers. Now, the person with whom I spoke obviously thinks it'd be just hunky-dory to be living in a garrison state. But that's the sort of thing against which I had an allergy, and I wish more people would come down with that allergic reaction. This is Pro Libertate Radio. I am Will Grigg. This is the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call number. 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. One 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. This is Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. I am William Grigg. I'm talking a little bit about SWAT teams. In particular, the SWAT team from Malheur County, Oregon, which I think is the nearest SWAT team, but quite likely won't be the nearest for long. This is a report from KTRV-TV, which is in Boise or Nampa. I can't remember which. I need to let you know a little bit more about the geography of where I live before I read this story. Malheur County, the French term Malheur means misfortune or bad luck, and it reflects an unfortunate incident involving an encounter between French fur trappers and traders and some of the local, I believe, Shoshone Indians, most likely out of Weezer, what's now Weezer, Idaho, in which the former came out on the short end of the stick, so to speak. Malheur County abuts the border with Idaho. And this part of Idaho and Oregon is known as the Treasure Valley, in large measure because it was a very lucrative trapping and fur trading zone. Payette is named after Francois Payette, who was a French fur trapper, and he actually, like most of the French fur trappers, got along pretty well with the Indians. They emphasized commerce rather than conflict, and for some reason that worked out well, particularly when you're talking about the Weezer, what was known as the Weezer Shoshone Indians. They were very commercially minded. They were very entrepreneurial. There are a lot of Indian communities in this part of the Northwest who are very entrepreneurial and not at all collectivist. They were much more entrepreneurial, unfortunately, than a lot of the European Americans who showed up, who were more corporatist and mercantilist in their outlook. The French were, for the most part, willing to do deals and get along in terms of mutually beneficial trade and commerce. So they got along for the most part. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case over in Malheur County, or what would become known as Malheur County. But Treasure Valley encompasses both that part of Oregon and the part of Idaho where I'm living. So with that preface, here we go with the story from the Fox affiliate in, I believe, Nampa, KTRV. The headline is, National SWAT Teams Train in the Treasure Valley. Students of a SWAT training school in Eagle, that's a town in Idaho, will be graduating in about a week. The students are already members of SWAT teams. They've simply come here to learn new techniques developed by military personnel. There we go. Those are incompatible mindsets. There is simply no way you can fuse those things. You cannot amalgamate the mindset of a peace officer with that of a soldier. Those are two apparently related but discrete mindsets, two different roles in society. A police officer, in the Western Anglo-Saxon tradition of liberty protected by law, is supposed to be somebody who is there in order to restore the peace by making sure that the rights of people are protected. And when he's dealing with somebody who's a suspected evildoer, you're dealing with a suspect, not with an enemy subject to summary extinction, or somebody who should be forced to submit at gunpoint and then taken hors de combat, as they say. You're dealing with somebody who has to be treated as an individual endowed with rights that are to be protected by the individual with the weapon or the bearing the insignia of being a peace officer. That's not the way a soldier functions. That's not the way a soldier should function, quite frankly. Let's see. The students are already members of SWAT teams. They've simply come here to learn new techniques developed by military personnel, techniques they also need to maintain while wearing protective gear designed for chemical warfare. Chemical warfare. Think about that for a second. They call us paranoid? These people are preparing to deal with chemical warfare in Treasure Valley, Idaho/Oregon. I think they've had some rude awakenings as far as the physical requirements that are involved and the fact that they are tested several times a day, said Chad Harbaugh, president of Government Training Institute. The 60-day course is administered through Idaho State University, and the men still have about 8 days left before heading back home. Once graduated, the men will be the first in the country categorized as Type 3 SWAT team members. The program was designed by the Government Training Institute. That's an organization about which I know nothing yet. I'll look into it. And we're told the course is something every SWAT team member will eventually graduate from. That is, if they want to keep their federal funding. Let me explain why I just theatrically emphasized those last five words. To keep their federal funding. What the federal government underwrites, it controls. Anything that receives so much as a farthing, a pittance of funding from the federal government, is owned by the federal government. And this is emphatically true with respect to nominally state and local law enforcement bodies. I've made reference to this before. I will do so again now. There was a court challenge several years ago in which the Bush administration successfully argued that a police car owned by the San Francisco Police Department that was set on fire during a protest was federal property. Because the San Francisco PD receives federal subsidies through the Homeland Security Department. What that means is that the federal government owns the entire department, lock, stock, and smoking barrels. All the fittings and fixtures, every thread of every uniform, that's all federal property. Now, the federal government, the Bush administration specifically, had made that argument because a local blogger had taken video of the protest. And one of the things he captured on video, digital video, of course, was the police car, which had been set on fire by protesters during, if I'm not mistaken, some kind of a trade conference that was being carried out in San Francisco. The federal government subpoenaed that footage. The blogger said, under the California Shield law, you don't have the right to get that footage. As a journalist, I'm protected by the Shield law. I don't have to disclose my sources. Now, the idea was that the footage contained, among other things, images of the protesters or some other type of video that could be forensically examined to determine the identity of the people who had attacked that police cruiser. And under the California Shield law, of course, it was protected. The ownership and the denial of access to that material were both protected. So the Bush administration tried to get around this by saying that the California Shield law doesn't apply. It's nullified, if you will, by virtue of the supposed fact that the federal government owns everything that belongs to that police department. And this was upheld after the blogger, whose last name was Wolf, I think his first name was Joshua, had spent a year in jail on a contempt of court citation because he had refused to turn over that footage on the basis of his lawfully protected rights under the California Shield Act. Well, here we have, in black and white, in this recently published account from Idaho, an admission of the fact that SWAT teams are federally funded paramilitary units. Now, this is the sort of thing we were predicting would happen back in 1994 when I was writing for the New American Magazine. Someday the federal government is going to take control of law enforcement using a combination of subsidies as bribes and civil rights actions as a form of blackmail. You'd have these police agencies. This is something else that I'd written about between 1994 and about 2001-2002. Police departments would be forced, city governments would be forced to sign consent decrees because of civil rights complaints. Now, my perspective on this question changed dramatically between about 1998 and 2005. I used to think that most of these consent decrees were the result of efforts by the ACLU and other groups I consider to be radical and completely unacceptable, ginning up, exaggerating, fabricating, embroidering, and otherwise exploiting incidents in which the police were put into a bad light because of things they did that looked bad but were justified. My opinion now is that many of these consent decrees represent a terrible remedy to a genuine problem, the genuine problem being increasingly commonplace and increasingly documented incidents of legitimate abuse of individuals by the police, not merely criminal suspects, but also people who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. That happens altogether too frequently. And so it is to the advantage of the federal government when you see misbehavior of the sort that unfortunately is becoming commonplace. But don't blame the feds for this. You can blame the feds for exploiting this by advancing this agenda of centralizing and militarizing law enforcement, which pretty much has been done. This is pretty much a fait accompli. Even when I was writing about this in the subjunctive mood, say, 16 years ago, if this happens, then this is what will be the result, we were dealing with law enforcement being pretty much a federalized undertaking anyway, precisely because of SWAT teams and in large measure because of the so-called war on drugs. I should point out that almost all the time that the SWAT team from Alier County is actually on the clock doing things that are considered to be actual law enforcement, they're arresting plants. That is to say, they're stomping around the trackless wilds of Malheur County, taking down marijuana grows. They're doing this with AR-15s in tow. Nobody's there. Nobody's ever around to challenge them, but just in case, they're loaded for bear. Well, there aren't many bears to be found in that part of Oregon. Not many crooks either. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network, 866-986-6397. Be back at you in a minute. System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Griggs.
I just got an email from a good friend of mine. He's a cyber acquaintance, never met him in person, corresponded with him a great deal by email and otherwise, and he's in both the military and in law enforcement, and he's a really decent guy from everything I've been able to learn about him. I've got a number of friends like that. It's interesting, this sense of immediacy you can develop by way of email and other electronic communication, in spite of the fact you've never met a person face-to-face. Now, he's writing about his perspective on why it is that every time I go to the park to exercise, I end up attracting the attention of police, even before the incident with the SWAT team this last week, which didn't have anything to do with me. They weren't there because I was there. But the day before, I had been to the park, and no fewer than 5 police cars showed up, including 1 undercover car. It's really quite remarkable. He writes, "Will, it's because you look black." Bear in mind, this is a guy, once again, who's both in law enforcement and the military. He continues, "When my mixed Asian friends, that is Caucasian/Asian, and I would play basketball at William and Mary at night after work, the cops would always show up. We could never figure out why. One night we had 4 cops show up to question us. Then one day I was not with my friends playing. My friend Chuck called me up and screamed into the phone that they had figured out why the cops always showed up. He said, 'It's you.' I answered puzzlingly what he meant by that. He replied, 'It's you.' 'What do you mean it's me?' 'It's you, huh? You're black. We were all playing last night and the cops never once stopped by. It's you.' I felt stupid for not realizing this." I don't know. There may be something to that. Look, I guess I do look black. I'm constantly told I look black. There is a wonderful blog called Good Grief. Well, it's devoted to the memory of Booker T. Washington. It's devoted to the Bookeristas, that is to say, people who are Americans of African heritage, of black African heritage, I further specify, who are either conservative or libertarian, and they insist on republishing a lot of what I write, and they have referred to me more than once as the black libertarian blogger from Idaho. And I guess the novelty is what sells the idea. Oh, there are bloggers in Idaho? What, you mean they got the internet out in Idaho? As I hear tell, they've got steam-powered ISPs out in Idaho. Well, no, we have internet. We have high-speed internet here, even in Payette, Idaho. I guess the novelty is the idea that there would be a libertarian blogger from Idaho and a black one on top of that. I'm not black, I'm dark brown. To the best of my knowledge, once again, my ancestry is Mexican on one side and Irish on the other. I've been able to pass for everything from Greek to Polynesian to Basque to Egyptian to, let me think, Italian. I've been asked if I was both Arab and Jewish on the same evening at the same function by 2 different people, obviously. One person was just certain that I was a Saudi. Another person was just as certain that I was, what, Sephardic Jewish or maybe even Ethiopian Jewish. Now, the latter doesn't make any sense because I'm of a much different somatotype from the Ethiopians. They're tall, they're small-boned, willowy. They tend to be very, very attractive people. I used to work with a group of Ethiopians at a JB's restaurant in Logan, Utah. They were Coptic Christians, as most of the Ethiopians are, and the men were all very handsome, and the women were all just gorgeous. It's the sort of thing I saw when I was in Egypt as well, among both the Copts and the Muslims in Egypt. They tend to be very attractive people. But as it turns out, I am Mexican-Irish, to the best of my understanding, and I'm an adopted child, never met my birth parents, probably never will, so I don't know for sure that there may have been somewhere in my distant ancestry somebody who was a black African. I don't know, but to the best of my knowledge, I'm not black, but in some of my photographs, I certainly do look black. Back when I was a basketball player in junior high and high school, a lot of people assumed I was black, and I took it as a compliment in that context, and I'm not particularly bothered by it. I'm not bothered by it in any sense now, but I am sort of puzzled over the possibility that there is some kind of low-grade racial profiling going on here, because there aren't many black people who live in Payette. There are a lot of Mexican people who live in Payette. There are a few people of scattered Indian tribal ancestry backgrounds here in Payette. But to the best of my knowledge, only a handful of people who are black. I think I know all of them, as a matter of fact. Yeah, we have to stick together, I suppose. That's a possibility. I don't know. Maybe there's some secret ordinance against being a large brown man exercising in public. It's just a little bit unsettling, in a way, a little bit annoying to be the recipient of that much inexplicable attention that consistently. Now, before the break, I was talking about this story dealing with national SWAT team training here in Treasure Valley that's conducted by the Government Training Institute. And the same friend who sent me this email sent me a link to the Government Training Institute website. And this is troubling because, once again, we're dealing with the consolidation and militarization of what remains of law enforcement by way of our friendly SWAT teams. The GTI, Government Training Institute, was founded in 2003. It appears to be a joint production of our good friends at the Pentagon and the Department of Homeland Security. You take a look at the curriculum offerings here. You look at the curriculum offerings here. They all deal with military operations and urban terrain. They don't use MOUT, military operations and urban terrain, specifically here, but what they're describing in terms of the piecemeal offerings do add up to MOUT-type training. Improvised explosive devices awareness, anti-terrorism force protection, close quarters battle, sniper, tactical breaching, tactical response to domestic violence. Boy, that's interesting. Tactical response to domestic violence. You want to talk about a recipe for somebody getting killed? There it is. Tactical response to terrorism. Unconventional warfare training. Undercover narcotics. That, of course, is part of a war. It's the war on drugs. It's very much a literal war. These are just some of the curriculum offerings being presented by the GTI, Government Training Institute. To continue now with the story from Fox News. The program was designed by the Government Training Institute, and we're told that the course is something every SWAT team member will eventually graduate from, that is, if they want to keep their federal funding. The training facility was built inside an old airplane hangar in Eagle near Old Horseshoe Bend Road. Harbaugh said in 2004, Department of Homeland Security officials decided all SWAT teams receiving federal funding needed to be categorized at Type 1, 2, or 3. Type 1, for instance, has to have robots. Robots? Dun 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 dun. Dun 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 dun. Dun 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 dun. They have to have explosive breaching capabilities. By the way, I think he misspelled breaching here. They have to have the ability to fast rope from a helicopter, said Harbaugh. He believes it's critical that officials at an instant scene know exactly what the SWAT teams and the there's another typo. Teams apostrophe S. No, it's plural, not possessive. Know exactly what the SWAT teams are capable of. If you don't know what a SWAT team should be capable of, your chances of operational success are highly diminished. Incidentally, this is the only facility where this type of training occurs, and Detective Pat Weber from Payette County, that's where I live, will be one of the first categorized SWAT team members in the country. There it is. They're training a SWAT team member from a county that doesn't have a SWAT team yet, and he's being trained using a federally defined curriculum and a Homeland Security / Pentagon defined training program to receive federal funding to build a Type 3 SWAT team here in Payette County. Payette County is, I would be surprised if there are as many as 25,000 people in Payette County. We don't have a particularly high crime rate. I'm happy to say that's one of the reasons I moved here. Nonetheless, we're going to be having a SWAT team because they're planting the seeds of it right now. The next time a terrorist act happens, it's not going to be flying planes into a building. It's going to be something locally, he said. What? His trainers are military men, special forces, teaching him how to deal with terrorists. Weber is looking forward to getting the rest of his team trained and categorized. That way, Payette can join Malheur County SWAT team or any other should the need arise. Get our team up to a level 3, and then if another team needs us, we can flow right in knowing that the training is the same, said Weber. Look, they're building a domestic army. How obvious does it have to be? These people are receiving military training. They're funded by the federal government. They're receiving instruction for the purpose of combining their forces in critical incidents. Now, the assumption is that they're being trained to deal with terrorists, to deal with high-risk, volatile circumstances involving firearms. To the best of my knowledge, the SWAT team in Malheur County has had exactly one incident of that sort. It was a carjacking that occurred earlier this year. They were present, and they did throw a few rounds at the people who were eventually corralled for this crime. They're going to serve, I think, up to 12 years in prison for their carjacking at gunpoint at a Les Schwab tire dealer in Ontario. But they were not decisive in that engagement. This actually was an instance of overkill. This is an instance of trying to find an incident to justify an existing capability. You know what? When they get the toys, they get the training, they get the insignia, they build their little team, they're going to be looking for reasons to be deployed. They're going to be looking for an excuse to throw down. If you don't believe me, read, oh, for heaven's sake, the Danny Colson's book. I believe it's called No More Heroes. Danny Colson was the founder of the hostage rescue team for the FBI. And he talks about the fact that if you've been trained and you've got the equipment, you want to go live. And they'll look for a reason to go live. And that's what worries me. As they're building this domestic army, this is domestic army that's going to create business for itself. So ends Hour 1 of Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Our call number is 866-986-6397. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, so stick around and I'd sure like to hear from you.